From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 400 years ago this year, Miguel de Cervantes published his second and final volume of the adventures of his self-imagined knight-errant Don Quixote. It told a story that then and now readers could laugh at and laugh with. The kind of cosmic comedy we are all, in our own ways, part of, with our fragile hopes and dreams and delusions. This hour On Point, the power and staying power of Cervantes' Don Quixote. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is that you? Is that all of us dreaming the impossible dream in our own ways, tilting at windmills with Don Quixote? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 400 years, and still it is one of the most published and read and translated books ever, right up there next to the Bible. On World Book Day this April, Spanish members of the European Parliament read excerpts of Don Quixote. Here's Pilar Ayuso reading from the third chapter of Don Quixote, where Quixote asks an innkeeper to make him a knight.
No me levantaré jamás de donde estoy, valeroso caballero, hasta que vuestra cortesía.
I shall never, O valorous knight, he says, arise from where I kneel until your courtesy vouchsafes me a boon which I desire to beg of you and will redound to your praise and to the benefit of humankind. And of course, it's all a magnificent delusion. Joining me now in the studio is Ilan Stavans, professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, Mexican-born, long now in the U.S., celebrated scholar and critic who has taught Don Quixote to many years of students. His new book is Quixote, the Novel and the World. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ilan Stavans, welcome back to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be back.
It's so wonderful to have you here. Read those opening lines in Spanish and then English for us, if you would, just to put us in the world of Cervantes and Quixote.
En un lugar de la Mancha, de cuyo nombre no quiero acordarme, no ha mucho tiempo que vivía un hidalgo de los de lanza en astillero, adarga antigua, rocín flaco y galgo corredor.
Which says,
somewhere in La Mancha, in a place whose name I do not care to remember, a gentleman lived not long ago, one of those who has a lance and ancient shield on a shelf and keeps a skinny nag and a greyhound for racing. This is the translation 2003 by Edith Grossman, the only female ever to translate Don Quixote.
Cervantes presents him to us, sitting there reading these stories of knights errant. And he is presented to us himself as an hidalgo. Take us into this world, this fictional character's presentation.
The novel takes place in the middle of Spain geographically and in the middle
La Mancha.
Of La Mancha, this important region, at a time when the Spanish Empire was in decline. And an hidalgo was a member of the nobility with idle time who would waste his energy and or money doing all sorts of needless activities. It often is said semantically that the word comes from hijo de algo, although there are other roots for the word meaning...
Hijo de algo meaning child of someone.
Of someone or of something, of uncertain root or of uncertain background.
May also, you say, suggest purity of blood, which in that Spanish context meant old Christian family.
That's right. This is about 100 plus years after the crucial Annus Mirabilis of 1492, when Spain decided to close its borders to anybody within that was considered undesirable. And it threw out first the Jewish population that had been there for centuries, and eventually the Muslim population as well. It was also the year in which Columbus sailed the ocean and discovered a new set of territories. The reality of Spain was that the country was in bankruptcy, the monarchy was in disarray, and Cervantes was a writer in search of an idea who was eager to make a buck.
So here's Cervantes. He takes on this epic thing that mocks the very thing it's modeled on. And you remind us that this is the kind of book, though it would have been heroically presented, the story of knights and derring-do
that people of this class would have read and read and read, and he has his character reading it until he loses his wits. What's the genre that he was pickled in here?
The famous genre, Tom, is chivalry novels. Maybe they are the equivalent today to detective fiction
or thrillers
or science fiction. There is a formulaic form of writing where people know and expect a type of hero, a type of adventure, a mythical quest, a beautiful lady. In Cervantes, who himself probably was this devout and devoted reader,
escapist literature, really, for anyone who read it.
Absolutely. And one of the fascinating aspects of the novel is that it could be considered a critique of reading. This is a character that reads and reads and reads until his brains dry up.
Loses his wits.
Right.
Almost just keeps right on going.
As if you were today a follower of superheroes, say Spider-Man or Batman, and you went so often to the movies or read the comic strips until you convinced yourself that you were Spider-Man or Batman, yeah, and went out and threw yourself off the building.
These novels, Spanish, if you will, modeled the stories of chivalry, the sort of Earth story there, El Cid.
El Cid is the basic one, the original one, the foundational one. There were many. It was a very popular genre all over Europe, in France, in Italy, in Portugal, in Spain. And it didn't have a sense of ownership. If somebody created a hero in the chivalry novel, somebody else, another author, could pick that hero up, mm-hmm, and create a new novel based on him. And that is something
another
that will
tale,
happen.
Another tale.
Until people were probably just saturated. But it doesn't seem as if they were saturated. This novel, Don Quixote, makes fun of the fact that there doesn't appear to be a limit to all this, to this excess of reading trash literature at the time, or in our time.
And the structure of these novels, which were so popular, in which he then takes, Cervantes takes and mocks, the structure very loose and baggy. You sort of introduce your hero and then have him go off on just a ton of adventures, any old thing, just keep bringing them in.
And if you're a good writer, you will keep the reader entertained. If you're a lousy writer, then you probably will lose that reader. And if there's one thing we can say about Cervantes is that he keeps us entertained even when he has fallen asleep at the wheel, even when one thinks that as an author, he is no longer in control of his creation.
I mean, what was it? You quote Mark Twain at the beginning of all this saying, a classic is a book people praise but don't read. Though he read this one, I guess.
He loved this one. In fact, in Huckleberry Finn, he pays tribute to it. Huck and Tom Sawyer want to be like Don Quixote and Sancho in plot adventures similar to those of Don Quixote and Sancho. Yeah. But maybe this is the perfect example of that sentence by Mark Twain. This is a book that everybody knows, but few people really open up. And if they do, many succumb to the difficulty of the first 3-4 chapters and, mm-hmm, don't pursue. I would say, Tom, this is a book that chooses its readers rather than the other way around.
But maybe the power of this, maybe what makes it a classic, is you really only have to understand the premise to kind of understand the book. I mean, you point to this as a kind of key that unlocked the entire modern era. It unlocked the whole sense of subjectivity. Here, Don Quixote, he looks out at the world and sees what he pleases to see. It questions the whole idea of truth. And it puts front and center our frailty as human beings, this sort of with the delusions that we're all in. We understand this innately, almost without cracking the book.
Yeah, but if you open the book, you will understand it even better. It is absolutely true. This is the book that, in my mind, invented modernity and invented subjectivity. You have a character that not only goes through La Mancha physically, but goes through La Mancha internally. There are all sorts of insights and epiphanies that he has through which he discovers a different type of self. Before Don Quixote, we don't have characters, or seldom do. that start in one place and emotionally end in another one, what the Germans call the Bildungsroman.
Mm-hmm.
This is the ultimate character that is transformed, and in so doing, transforms us as readers as well. And it is the book that declares openly forever that your dreams should be the traction that pushes and propels your life, and that your dreams might clash with reality, but if they are yours, if you're ready to fight for them, they can take you far, and you might change reality itself. The subjectivity of presenting truth as based on the individual and not as the church wanted it, as controlled by an institution that oversees just about everything, is a dramatic revolution of which we're still feeling the impact.
I mean, yes, it certainly says that, but at the same time, it presents Quixote as risible, as pathetic, as tattered and torn as we sing in the Impossible Dream
Aren't
song.
Aren't we all pathetic,
yes,
and ridiculous?
Most certainly.
I think that that is why it's so popular. We, each of us, in our insignificant dreams, are little worms trying to find our own place in the universe. And the book tells us that that if you don't pursue those dreams, you really are not going to be satisfied. I think precisely the frailty, the ridiculousness, the kind of limitation that he has is what attracts audiences and has done so for 400 years.
Frail as we may be. Ilan Stavins is with us. What a treat. He's writing about Don Quixote in his new book, Quixote, the Novel and the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Behind us, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza from the Sofia National Opera Orchestra in Bulgaria. This book is everywhere. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Ilan Stavins. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this power about the real power of a mock epic, the 400-year run of Don Quixote, and what draws us back again and again to the core story of the classic tale of Cervantes, of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, his sidekick, and Dulcinea, his love interest in tilting at windmills, the quixotic, all of that. With Ilan Stavins, his new book is Quixote, the Novel and the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us at 800-423-8255. What is it that keeps this book going, keeps it speaking to every generation, to George Washington and Herman Melville and Dostoevsky and Faulkner, Picasso, maybe to you? Are we all tilting at windmills, lost in our own shaky dreams of grandeur, of meaning, but finding meaning anyway in that pursuit? 800-423-8255 is our number. Ilan Stavins joins me in the studio. Read a bit more. This is the character that Cervantes gives us. He is there reading and reading and reading. This is Alonso Quijano, he who will soon imagine himself as Don Quixote. Could you read a bit, maybe in English here?
In short, our gentleman became so caught up in reading that he spent his nights reading from dusk till dawn and his days reading from sunrise to sunset. And so with too little sleep and too much reading, his brains dried up, causing him to lose his mind. His fantasy filled with everything he had read in his books, enchantments as well as combats, battles, challenges, wounds, courtings, loves, torments, and other impossible foolishness. And he became so convinced in his imagination of the truth of all the countless grandiloquent and false inventions he read that for him no history in the world was truer.
Ilan Stavins reading from Don Quixote. And soon enough, he's out with his old nag and his battered old armor and shield and Sancho Panza at his side, tilting at windmills. Here's one dramatic reproduction of that, the 2000 television film adaptation. Don Quixote is played here by John Lithgow. His squire, Sancho Panza, played by Bob Hoskins. Looking for adventure, they come across a field of windmills. Don Quixote sees violent giants, but Sancho Panza sees something rather different.
I can't see no giants exactly.
Poor in brains. What do you know about adventure? See their arms waving? Some of that detested race have arms a mile long, but I shall bring them to their knees.
They're not arms, sir. They're the saddles of windmills. Harmless devices for grinding corn, so they tell me.
Harmless devices, indeed. Go in a corner and pray if you have no stomach for this business. Hear me, giants! The combat is unequal, but I fight for heaven and the maiden Dulcinea del Toboso!
John Lithgow as Don Quixote goes after the windmills. We'll look at many of the ways in which Don Quixote has been presented in opera and stage and Broadway and all the rest. Ilan Stavins is with me in the studio. Lots of callers for you. Alfred in Providence, Rhode Island. Alfred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Yes. What do you see? What do you read?
Well, I've always loved the story of Don Quixote, and one of the things that I find strange about it as I've gotten older is there's a really strange contradiction in the story. On the one hand, Don Quixote is this buffoon. He's obviously being horribly abused for his fantasies. I mean, he is beaten up numerous times. But at the same time, as the story goes on, you can't help but feel that the world he inhabits is, I mean, it's the real world, but it's so horrible and it's so ugly that you begin to sympathize more and more with him in the same way that Sancho Panza does. And so that by the end of the book, you really don't want him to ever wake up from this dream. And he kind of does at the very end, you know, and it's just so tragic because his world is so much more beautiful and interesting, really, than this grubbing world of, you know, of people just, basically beating each other up and trying to get ahead, for money and whatnot. There's this strange dream. So in a way, we become Don Quixote through the course of the story.
Alfred, you've got your finger right on it. Ilan Stavins nodding along here. And if we're looking for the secret of why this stays so enduringly popular, maybe that's it. And maybe especially right now, you look out and you see all this, whoa, and here's a man who, as beaten down as he may become, he's living somehow a beautiful life, better than truth.
We indeed become Don Quixote, all of us, each of us, as Alfred says. This might well be also the cruelest book ever written. Nabokov hated it. He thought the violence that not only other characters, but the author himself inflicts on his two protagonists is unseemly and excessive. And at the very end, as your listener will know, even the other characters are sad that he is dying and try to convince him not to stop being Don Quixote and return to being Alonso Quijano, for they themselves need this type of dreamer in order
to
continue.
Don't let the book end, the movie end, the dream end.
We need that type of fool in order to inspire us to become someone ourselves.
And that is, as you say, subjectivity comes out here, and maybe truth beyond fact.
And that is why, Tom, the word Quixote has become an adjective. I can't think of any other literary character whose name has become an adjective in as many languages as this. We are quixotic even when we don't read the book.
You call it a or the cornerstone of Hispanic culture, even the cult of a word I didn't know, Quixotismo?
Quixotismo.
Meaning?
That which is dreamlike or buffonish or a clownish. I think this book has the DNA of our civilization. I think
when you say our here, do you mean global or Hispanic?
I certainly think Hispanic civilization begins and ends in this book. I would even suggest that the Spanish language was created in order for this book to exist. It is what justifies us. It has our goals and also our limitations. It explains how we were born out of the decline of an empire, how we are in an eternal quest, how we can be very spiritual without always believing in God, and how we need friendship and love, but are trapped in solitude, a solitude that takes us from one place to another. It is a book that grows with you, as this reader says. When I first read it, I was a young man, and I thought it was the book of a fool and maybe a lunatic. Now that I am the age of Don Quixote, 50-ish, I now see that it is very much like the rest of us. Dreamers pursuing sometimes a ghost or a chimera that will justify your life.
That, as the cornerstone of a culture, that we need to explore more. Wendy in New Orleans first. Wendy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Elon.
Hello.
I think Don Quixote is probably one of the most timeless novels ever, and I think the writer knew 21st century America pretty well, because I think politically the Spain that produced Don Quixote is the America we see today, with Trump wanting to build a wall, with politicians wanting our America, protecting our Christian values, you know, that kind of thing. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
You mean the fallen empire in a way, Wendy, or dreaming of a restoration of what has passed somehow? Is that
restoration of what has passed, not an inability to recognize that time is changing, much like Spain in Cervantes' time?
Wendy, thank you so much. Ilan, what about it? That or trying to push forward?
Tom, I believe that good literature doesn't have the responsibility to be easy, to surrender itself to you. And also, good literature is a manual for life. This book teaches us how to be, and certainly as Americans, this book teaches us how to live life. I sometimes wish that our politicians would have the time, the energy, and the determination to just sit down and read it. Maybe somebody like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, just take a summer and delve into this extraordinarily complex book. I think that perceiving us all as criminals or as ignorant would fall down immediately.
And again, when you say us, in that case, you mean Latino, Mexican immigrants?
Mexicans, immigrants. I'm originally from Mexico.
Yeah.
Latin Americans in general, Hispanics. There is so much that this book says about traveling from one place to another,
yeah,
about the concept of what home is, and about what friendship is all about. And I think one of the limitations of Cervantes' time is that politicians didn't read. And maybe we haven't overcome that limitation in our time either.
But if this is a cornerstone of Hispanic culture, maybe this is also something about the rub where traditional American culture, more northern European, let's say, and Latin or Hispanic culture, where they rub against one another. I mean, that fallen state that led to the subjective and this sort of finding glory even in disrepair, that's never really been accepted at the heart of the traditional American. It was always purposeful. It was always striving. I mean, even now, that's the mythology. Future-looking, optimistic, constructive.
But this is also a very individualistic society, and a society that believes that if you have a dream, the American dream, you will ultimately succeed, and there is social mobility. Mobility is what keeps the two main characters from one place to another all the time. You know, this is the most Spanish of books and the least Spanish of books. This book is both a celebration of what Spain and the Hispanic world are all about and a severe critique of what Spain and the Hispanic world are all about. Everybody appropriates this book in one way or another. The Russians during the communism loved it. This was a dreamer that went out and tried to help others, the true communist. George Washington loved him, and so did Jefferson, because this is a book that speaks to the dreamer that will do something for himself.
Yeah.
it seems to me that this universality that one of the listeners was talking about is right on the spot. But what is fascinating about the book is that I don't think Cervantes wanted to write a universal book. Cervantes did a very local, very particular book, and in emphasizing the local, he found the universal.
Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Camille, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. I saw this performed a couple of years ago by a local company, and it finally occurred to me, I've always loved the story, but it finally occurred to me that Cervantes is a wise fool. He's the archetype of the wise fool who knows that we have to have dreams. And sometimes you have to look like a fool when you are following your dreams. But also, he sees the best in everyone. He redeems Aldonza by calling her by another name. And I think in that, he is also kind of a Jesus figure.
A Jesus figure, no doubt. Often, Camille, in history, people have brought the religious aspect to the book. Dostoevsky believed that Cervantes had created a variation of the Gospels, and Miguel de Unamuno had a similar opinion. I think that you're right on track when you suggest that this is a wise fool. My impression is that Cervantes wants us to believe that reason and foolishness are not antonyms, are not opposites, that there is reason in foolishness and foolishness in reason. And that is why this character is so attractive, because he combines the two.
Camille notes that she's responding to a performance that she saw. Now, I'm assuming, Camille, was that Man of La Mancha that you saw performed, the stage play,
yes.
The musical?
Yes. By a local company.
Yeah, what about that, Ilan? This is the Broadway version of Don Quixote. There have been many, many kinds of presentations, but what about the Broadway version and what it does, where it takes the story?
The Broadway version is probably the entrance door to many into the novel, for better or worse. It is an adaptation. It perverts or falsifies different elements. It gives you the impression, for instance, that Cervantes wrote the novel in a dungeon while he was a prisoner. He was imprisoned because of a fraud, and not because the Inquisition was after him. There are other elements in it that tend to collapse different episodes. But, you know, the critic is always complaining, and here I am saying that the musical is not what it should be. The fact is that the musical has enthralled people, and hopefully if one out of every 10 that have seen the musical go to the novel and figure out what it is, I think that Cervantes, certainly me, would be satisfied.
To dream the impossible dream, of course, the story, the big song that came out of that, so many people have sung it, Frank Sinatra made it famous. You talk about its debonair delivery, makes you feel you should never renounce your own goals. Is that a fair distillation?
I think it's a fair distillation. I love the many versions. There's one with salsa of the Impossible Dream. I've heard it in different languages. In Spanish, I love the idea that this song had to be translated into Spanish in order to be heard and understood in the among Spanish speakers in the Hispanic world. This is a book about translation in numerous ways. There's one moment at the very end of the second part, really the last chapter, where Cervantes says that Don Quixote, now in his deathbed, it was born for him and for him alone, and that he and his character are one and the same, and that nobody's going to steal the character away from him. But Tom, we haven't done anything else but steal the character away from Cervantes. All these adaptations and translations and reconfigurations are a way to look at the novel from other perspectives. And they are forms of reading. They are forms of celebration. They are tributes. If people don't go back to the novel, well, in my view, they will be missing an essential part. But Cervantes succeeded in not only writing a terrific book, but in giving the world this iconic, mythical couple, two friends that navigate together, and that is enough.
Don Quixote, Sancho Panza, and of course, the Dulcinea. Caller Camille says, Jesus figure. Lon Stavin says, yes, indeed, in some ways. We're talking about the real power of a mock epic, the 400-year run of Don Quixote. Behind us, of course, Frank Sinatra, Old Blue Eyes with the Impossible Dream from the Broadway adaptation of Don Quixote. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This is my quest to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to be willing.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
That my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real power of a mock epic, the 400-year run of Don Quixote, what draws us back and back and back to the great classic of Miguel Cervantes. Classic today, but a breakthrough in its time took us into the realms of subjectivity and a new kind of examination of truth, says my guest today, Ilan Stavins. He is professor in Latin American Latino culture at Amherst College and author of the new book, Quixote, The Novel and the World. 1972 movie adaptation of the Broadway musical Man of La Mancha. Peter O'Toole played Don Quixote, and here he's awakened. He no longer believes he's Don Quixote, the knight-errant. The village beauty, Aldanza, called Dulcinea by Don Quixote, tries to remind him of his quest.
Perhaps it was not a dream.
You spoke of a dream? And about the quest?
The quest?
How you must fight? And it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, if only you follow the quest.
The quest, the quest. Mike in Milwaukee, you're on with Ilan Stavins. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. When I was pre-med years ago, I had just finished wading through an uncondensed Moby Dick. I was sort of weary. I was going to begin the Quixote, but a friend of mine on campus who was a Spanish major told me not to waste my time because to appreciate it, it had to be read in its native Castilian Spanish. And so I put it off, and I'm a retired physician now. And the other thing is that, to my knowledge, there's never been a first-class film of it made, despite the fact that Orson Welles couldn't get the financing for it, and John Huston, two of the great American filmmakers, wanted to star his father, Walter, and he wasn't box office enough. So I have two questions. Is there a fine translation, and is there a fine film? Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Ilan.
Mike, I'll start with the second question. Is there a fine film? No, there are many unfine films, many attempts, but no success. And maybe this is a movie that cannot and should not be adapted into film. It lives better in and through words. The first question, is there a fine translation? You know, Mike, there are 20 full, complete translations of Don Quixote into English.
Alone.
And
it's translated into Korean and
every single imaginable standard language standardized. 20 different translations. I would submit that the English language is richer in Don Quixote's than the Spanish language. We only have one. We have the one, the Castilian, the original, the sacred, the untouchable. In English, there are 20 ways to enter the novel. The very first one, it appeared even before the second part of the book had been finished in 1612.
Incredible. I had no idea.
And in the last one was just published a few years ago. There is an Elizabethan translation and a Victorian and a translation of the First World War and the Second World War. And if you are crazy like me and try to open more than one, if you try to open 20, you can actually navigate through the development of the English language and see how language has changed to describe Don Quixote. And you will also see how English language readers have been absolutely enthralled with this. They keep on translating it.
You're not buying that you have to read it in Castilian Spanish and Spanish to have it.
I hope that the dream, the impossible dream, is that Mike, now that he's retired, can learn Castilian and read it in the original. But dreams are impossible, and a translation sometimes can be just as good, and in the case of one or two books, better than the original. I don't think that this is the case. There are other Spanish language books, 100 Years of Solitude, where the translation is maybe better than the original.
Gabriel,
I think
Garcia
that the phone probably is going to start ringing now even more. But there are some wonderful translations into English of Don Quixote. And if you read Edith Grossman, which modernizes the novel, or if you read the John Ormsby at the end of the 19th century that keeps the archaic flair, mm-hmm. and I love very mm-hmm. much, you will see a very different novel. You could even argue that Americans or English readers have an easier time because they have 20 doors to enter, mm-hmm. whereas the original Spanish language readers only have one, and that was published in 1605 and 1615.
Fantastic. We'll hear a little Spanglish translation by Ilan Stobbins in a moment. Mike, thank you for your call. Moby Dick to Don Quixote, your ambitious Albert in Miami. Albert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Tom, you're on point. Great show.
Thank you, Albert. What do you know?
I wanted to make note, I'm a first-generation American. I come from, Cuban parents that left in the 60s.
Okay.
They had a bit of their own nobility there. They were high society. They had money. They came over here to nothing. They had it was required reading in our house to basically be Don Quixote and make imagination out of nothing. And they made their life. Now they've grown. They've had businesses. They're successful here in the United States. Cuba's opening up now. I have no experience in Cuba. I'm heading to Cuba for the first time.
Wow.
And I see that nostalgia that I imagined through Don Quixote of what my Cuba was or could be and Spain before that. And I see it all now coming to a head. It's kind of I'm finishing the book in real time. I just find it kind of nostalgic.
And do you see your parents as having been lost in nostalgia in it or somehow won some kind of freedom in it, different than their American freedom?
I think honestly they found some freedom in it in that they were able to revel and almost build a new color to the picture that they had of Cuba. There is, and that's where there might be a little bit of loss in translation in that they're reaching for something they once had, and maybe, and you know, you have a tendency of imagining things greater than they were, the big fish story. But I'm headed back to Cuba. Or for my first time.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see if I can reimagine it through his eyes. I'm definitely going to take a page from Don Quixote and Cervantes to try to find my own imagination there, you know?
Watch out for the windmills there in Cuba, Albert. I appreciate your call. Ilan, the way in which this is a receptacle that carries Hispanic culture across the Florida Straits, the Cuba Straits, into Miami and all the rest?
Tom, nostalgia is the desire to go back to something that no longer exists. It's not to go back to mm-hmm. a place that is still there. And that Don Quixote does very well. He creates the idea of home. He invents it. And I think that even Cuba today, I was just there a few months ago, could be described as very quixotic.
In what sense?
In the sense of having tried to invent their own dreams. Maybe we didn't agree, those mm-hmm. that are not in mm-hmm. Cuba, with those dreams. But the pursuit of some sort of equality, some sort of fairness, an alternative view of things.
Yes.
Some dreams are aborted. Some dreams, when they become a reality, mm-hmm. are painful to recognize. But Cuba, from 1959 to the present, is a region that tried to offer a parallel way
to make their dream come true.
The world.
Wow. Once something becomes quixotic, does that mean it's a proven failure?
It is an invitation to see failure as an essential part of who we are. Without failure, we don't know what success is.
And we don't move.
We need to have a taste of that. And that is not only one experience. Failure keeps on coming, just as success does. And they are intrinsic to the way we see ourselves. And the parallel universes of what we dream, what our imagination wants, and what the reality that we have in front of us offers, that clash between the two is what this novel is all about. And it's what we all are about.
Be drawn to the quixotic sometimes. It's a way to move beyond the confine, the prison of the...
Please, never immediate. Give up on that quixotic, however you define it.
Kamali in Boston. Kamali, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I tried to read... Don Quixote a few years ago, the unabridged version, and I just wanted to talk about a couple of my favorite parts.
Yes, please.
So there's one part where Don Quixote is walking next to a group of prisoners that are being escorted, and it was very humorous as he sort of tries to defend all the prisoners, and they make reference to these kind of to the gun that the that's being held as they escort him. They call it a fire stick.
Yes.
And he's defending the prisoners, and then they sort of turn on them in their bid to escape, and he gets hit in the face with a rock, and it's very humorous. And then there was another great scene where they're on a hillside, and they're looking at Don Quixote is looking at a flock of sheep and sort of dust being kicked up, and it's this very dramatic description of him seeing them as like at different armies and different banners. And it would be great to see that conceptualized in some sort of film or something. But so that always stuck with me. And the last point I'll make is they say that it was like the first novel of sort of the modern form.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was, I found it to be kind of boring. Even though it was great and beautiful and transports you, it was hard to, it never had sort of a plot buildup. It's just sort of episode after episode for
yes, exactly. Exactly. Elon Stobbins is not going to argue that point with you, Kamali. Our time grows short, but I appreciate your call, those scenes you bring to life, and the fact that it is kind of a baggy, big, endless
book. It's an imperfect book. It's episodic. It's some sections, one wonders why they are there. I think it's important, at least one of the great pleasures that I have is to be able to introduce this book to students every year or every other year. To bring a new generation to it, but it would be foolish to tell them that this is a perfect book. This is a book with all sorts of limitations, like us readers, and books don't have the obligation, again, to be coherent. This book survives because people bring into it all sorts of memories and all sorts of affections and loyalties, and that is what makes it so unique, the fact that everybody takes something out of it in a different way.
Kamali, thanks for your call. Ilan, you've done a translation, a Spanglish translation. Some of us will follow this easily. Some may not. It's about Don Quixote. He comes across lions in a cage, and he decides he has to prove he's not afraid of the lions. You want to read a bit for us?
Let me very quickly say that Spanglish is the language of 60s. Maybe 65 million Latinos in the United States.
It's a hybrid of
English and Spanish. And I felt as a Latino that my duty was to bring Cervantes and Don Quixote into it, because if a translation is a form of appropriation, we need to have our own Don Quixote. And this comes from the second part, chapter 17, to which Don Quixote replied, smiling un poco, Leoncitos to me? To me, leoncitos, and at such hours? Pues Dios will show those señores bringing them along if yo soy a man who is frightened by leones. Move aside, good hombre, and if you are the leonero, open those jaulas and let the beasts salir afuera, for in the middle of this campaña I shall let them know who is Don Quixote de la Mancha in spite and in defiance of the encantadores who have sent them a me.
Ah, and the lions, we will do the leones. I love a little Spanglish in Ilan Stobbins' own translation there. One more call. Emilio is calling from El Paso, Texas. Emilio, thank you for calling. You're on with Ilan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted just to mention that for years as I was growing up, born and raised in Mexico, my father tried to get me to read the book. And for years I tried until, I heard an audiobook. I could never get past the first 5-6 chapters. They were dense to me.
Yeah.
And then when I heard the comic verses that Don Quixote puts on the first few pages, spoken, it yeah. was like magic. I mean, that turned completely my attitude around, and I could then go to the book and get started there. And if you made...
Hey, Emilio, did you listen in Spanish or in English to this audiobook?
Well, actually, they have both. I mean, obviously, they have both.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The one that I heard was an English version.
Okay, actually. Okay, good.
And it's tremendously funny comic. But they have a version that came out in 2004 when the 400th anniversary of the first edition came mm-hmm. out. And it's as funny, obviously. But I think that's one of the ways that you could get younger people interested in reading the whole book. Because once you made it past those verses, and probably the first 15 to 17 chapters, it will grab you. I mean, it's one of the few books that I have actually laughed out loud reading.
Emilio, I love it. We're up against the clock here, but only 15 or 16 chapters, and you may be into it. I'd love to picture you listening there. He seems somehow, Quixote, he seems more appropriate than ever to our time. Maybe it's every time where we feel like we're tilting at windmills and failing and rising again, but he seems terribly appropriate these days.
Terribly appropriate. Relevant. This is a world, the one we live in, that seems to be falling apart. And this always offers us a way in, either is it through comic strips or through Broadway musicals or in a launchback that you have an image of Sancho mm-hmm. and Don Quixote stamps if you go to Spain or if you don't. Don Quixote will be with you and it can be your companion through life. It will grow as you grow. It will show you things as you show it things. That is one of the great pleasures of having a classic. As you navigate through life, it is always next to you.
Even love, romantic love, Dulcinea from the 1965 Broadway musical, Richard Kiley singing here, serenading his love, Dulcinea. Ilan Stavins, it's always a pleasure. The new book is Quixote, the novel, and the world. How wonderful to have you with us for an hour. Thanks so much for coming
in. It's a pleasure to be here and to have an opportunity to speak to listeners and to speak to you, Tom.
The pleasure is mine, sir. Oh, pretty soon we're going to get all Cervantes here. Cervantes died on the same day of the Julian calendar as William Shakespeare. Interesting in itself. We'll talk about it another time. Ilan, thanks so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dulcinea, Dulcinea, I have sought thee, sung thee, dreamed thee, Dulcinea. Now I found thee, and the world shall know thy glory, Dulcinea. Dulcinea.